Thanks, Rob. Tim, alcoholic. So as you said, page 446, our story tonight is He Lived Only to Drink in part three. And it's a fourth edition story. We have some pretty good detail about this author. Rob's going to put up a picture in a second. But I think the reason we like to start off this way is the reason that this story was chosen to be in the big book is that this is a real Yale to jail story. And in addition to that, our author is African American. So I think he represents for there also. And with that being said, let's get started. I had been preached to, analyzed, cursed, and counseled, but no one ever said, I identify with what's going on with you. It happened to me, and this is what I did about it. And Rob's going to put a little picture up. This is Phil Parker. And that's an undated picture. So I don't know when it was, but that is our author. So let's get going. On looking back at my life, I can't see anything that would have warned me or my family of the devastation that alcoholism had in store for us. To our collective memory, there was no drinking on either side of the family. We were from a long Southern missionary Baptist tradition. My father was a minister, and I attended his church every Sunday with the rest of the family and, like them, was very active in religious work. My parents were also educators. My father was principal of the school I attended, and my mother taught there. They were both champions of community outreach and well-respected. There was caring and togetherness among us. My maternal grandmother, herself a deeply religious woman who lived with us, helped raise me and was a living example of unconditional love. So he was born in 1930 in Philadelphia, but he was actually raised in South Carolina. Early on, the values of morality and learning were impressed on me. I was taught that if you were well-educated and morally upstanding, there was nothing that could stand in the way of your success in this life or the hereafter. As a child and young man, I was evangelical, literally drunk with moral zeal and intellectual ambition. I excelled in school and dreamed of a career in teaching and helping others. It was not until I was an adult, away from the family and doing graduate work at a prestigious East Coast university, that I had my first real drink of alcohol. I had tasted beer and a little wine before that, and long since decided that fruit juice tasted better. I had never been inside a bar until one evening, some fellow students persuaded me to go with them to a local cocktail lounge. I was fascinated. I still remember the hazy, smoky atmosphere, the hushed voices, the tinkle of the ice in the glasses. It was pure sophistication. But most of all, I remember that first sensation of the warm whiskey radiating through my body. So he does tell us here that he went to a prestigious East Coast university, a very prestigious. He actually did his graduate work at Harvard, and he got his BS at Morehouse College in Atlanta. He got the master's in teaching. I drank so much that night that nobody believed I hadn't been drinking all the time, and I didn't get drunk, although there were parts of the evening that I didn't remember the next day. But more important than anything else that night, I belonged. I was at home in the universe. I was comfortable with people. Despite my active church and school life as a child, I had never felt really comfortable. I was actually very nervous and insecure around people, and most of the time forced myself to be outgoing like my parents because I thought it was my duty. But this night in the bar was like no other time in my life. Not only was I completely at ease, but I actually loved all the strangers around me, and they loved me in return, I thought, all because of this magic potion, alcohol. What a discovery. What a revelation. The following year, I began my career as a teacher, My first job was at a college 50 miles from my hometown. But the school year before the school year ended, I had been asked to resign because of my drinking. Within that short space of time, drinking had become an accepted way of life. I loved booze. I loved people who drank and the places where they drank. At that time in my life, although I had lost my first job and embarrassed my family, it never occurred to me that alcohol could be a problem. From that first night at the bar a year earlier, I had made a profound decision that was to direct my life for many years to come. Alcohol was my friend, and I would follow it to the ends of the earth. And in case you missed that, he went from his first drink of real booze in graduate school, and within approximately 1 year, was already talking like this about it, that he would follow it to the ends of the earth, and had already been fired from his first job. One of many. After that first job, there were many more that I lost, all because of my drinking. I taught in many schools and in many states. I was no longer the moral young man who had seen his destiny in helping people live better. I was loud and arrogant, angry, abusive, always blaming and confronting others. I was getting arrested and beaten up. I had developed a foul mouth and was frequently drunk in classes and in public places. Finally, my teaching career ended in total dishonor. My family could not understand what was happening to me, nor could I. In moments of clarity, I was full of shame, guilt, and remorse. I had become an embarrassment to all who had had faith in me. To others, I had become a joke. I wanted to die. Now alcohol had become the only friend I had. I wound up in an insane asylum, which probably saved my life. I do not remember how I got there. I do know that I had become suicidal. I became comfortable there, and months later, I cried when I was dismissed. I knew by that time that I could not make it in the world. I was safe behind the barred hospital windows and wanted to stay there for the rest of my life. I could not drink there, but tranquilizers and other drugs abounded, and I helped myself to them. The word alcoholic was never mentioned. I do not believe the doctors knew much more about alcoholism than I did. When I was released from the asylum, I moved to a large city to make a new beginning. He actually moves to New York City under the idea that he's going to go there and he's going to write his first novel. My life had become a series of new beginnings. In time, I picked up the drink, got good jobs, and lost them as I had in the past. All the fear and remorse and terrible depression returned tenfold. It still did not register that the drinking might be the cause of all this misery. I sold my blood. I prostituted myself. I drank more. I became homeless and slept in the bus and train terminals. I scrounged cigarette butts off the sidewalks and drank from a common wine bottle with other drunks. I drank my way to the men's municipal shelter and made it my home. I panhandled. By this time, I lived only to drink. I did not bathe or change clothes. I stank. I became thin and ill. I had begun to hear voices and accepted them as death omens. I was frightened, arrogant, enraged, and resentful of man, God, and the universe. There was nothing else to live for, but I was too frightened to die. And what he's talking about, Rob's going to put up another photo here. What he's talking about is the infamous Third Street Men's Shelter down right off the Bowery. And this was considered back in the day, and I'll get you oriented date-wise in a second, but this was considered, hell. It was at this point that a woman who was a social worker on Skid Row and a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous sat me down in her office and told me her story, how she drank, what happened, and how she got sober. No one had ever done this before. I had been preached to, analyzed, cursed, and counseled, but no one had ever said, I identify with what's going on with you. It happened to me, and this is what I did about it. She got me to my first AA meeting that same evening. So this is 1969, just for a little orientation. The people at the meetings gathered around me in kindness in those early days, and I did not drink. But the spiritual demons of withdrawal descended on me. I was black and these people were white. What did they know about suffering? What could they tell me? I was black and bright, and the world had constantly rejected me for it. Consistently rejected me for it. I hated this world, its people, and its punishing God. Yet I believed the people in AA were sincere, and whatever they believed in was working for them. I just did not believe that AA would work for me as a black drunk. I genuinely believed that I was different until much later, when I had what I now know to be my first spiritual awakening, that I was an alcoholic and I didn't have to drink. I also learned that alcoholism, as an equal opportunity illness, does not discriminate, is not restricted to race, creed, or geography. At last, I was released from the bondage of my uniqueness. In early sobriety, I had to continue to live in a flop house filled with active drunks. Not drinking, I became acutely aware of my surroundings, the foul smells, the noise, the hostility, and physical danger. My resentments mounted at the realization that I had flushed a career down the drain, disgraced and alienated my family, and been relegated to the meanest of institutions, a Skid Row shelter. But I was also able to realize that this bonfire of resentment and rage was beckoning me to pick up a drink and plunge into my death. Then I realized that I had to separate my sobriety from everything else that was going on in my life. No matter what happened or didn't happen, I couldn't drink. In fact, none of these things that I was going through had anything to do with my sobriety. The tides of life flow endlessly for better or worse, both good and bad. And I cannot allow my sobriety to become dependent on these ups and downs of living. Sobriety must live a life of its own. So that's interesting, because what I sort of gleaned out of that was the idea he almost took a second, he almost took a first step a second time, powerless over booze. And then this later in early sobriety almost seems like he's talking about that these resentments and this terminal uniqueness, he had to accept his powerlessness over that and separate it from sobriety, that it was not conditional, it was not transactional, that the fact of the matter is it was one and then the other. And I think that's important. And I kind of see it in the next sentence. More important, I came to believe that I cannot do this alone. From childhood, despite the love I experienced, I had never let people, even those closest to me, inside my life. All my life, I had lived the deepest of lies, not sharing with anyone my true thoughts and feelings. I thought I had a direct line to God, and I built a wall of distrust around myself. In AA, I faced the pervasive we of the 12 steps and gradually realized that I can separate and protect my sobriety from outside hazards only in so much as I rely on the sober experience of other AA members and share their journey through the steps to recovery. Almost like he's having the spiritual experience of the fellowship as being the manifestation of God. It's like a whole new understanding of his spiritual thing. He's like almost separating from his spirituality that he, you know, had in childhood. The rewards of sobriety are bountiful, and as progressive as the disease they counteract. Certainly among these rewards for me are release from the prison of uniqueness and the realization that participation in the AA way of life is a blessing and a privilege beyond estimate. A blessing to live a life free from the pain and degradation of drinking and filled with the joy of useful, sober living, and a privilege to grow in sobriety one day at a time and bring the message of hope as it was brought to me. I got to tell you, A, I think it's a powerful story, but B, the guy is really humble because I read his obit in the New York Times, and it's powerful. So let's get a little bit more orientation here. I did tell you his last name. So obviously he's passed. He passed on June 15th, 2016, at the age of 86 years old. At that time, he had 47 years sobriety. And a little bit of a guesstimate here, but I think he's writing the story with about 30 years sobriety. And under that heading of humility, him being a humble person, he ultimately becomes a social worker. And within that career, he becomes a supervisor and eventually gets a managerial role for the New York City Department of Social Services, and actually developed programs that were very successful to get homeless men, alcoholics, addicts, rehabilitated and back into society. One of the alumni associations wrote this about him, and it was in his obit. I'll just read it, it's a short thing. His concept of rehabilitation was group therapy combined with supervised work assignment in phases of increasing responsibility, underlined by 12-step principles of recovery from alcoholism and other addictions. A former commissioner of the Department of Social Services said that the programs that he developed, paraphrasing now, were very effective. So obviously, here's a guy that was in the system, alcoholic, addict. You know, nobody knows best how to, you know, work with our brethren than our brethren. And here he is. He's also highly educated. So I think he's really bringing the goods to the deal. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you so much.